Blog Talk Radio.
Gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, this is the 411 Ground and Pound Radio Show, your weekly look into the wide, wacky, wonderful world of mixed martial arts. I'm your host, Robert Winfrey, and I want to thank you all so very much for joining us on this Sunday, the 19th of June. It is Father's Day, so to all the dads out there, happy Father's Day. Keep doing what you're doing. If you're doing a good job, if you're, you know, not, step it up. But to all the dads out there, you know, have a good day. Know that you're appreciated. Know that you're loved. And, you know, just keep doing what you're doing. We need more good people in this world, and good fathers are more difficult to come by than they should be. All right, tonight on the discussion table, primarily last night's UFC Fight Night 89, Stephen Thompson versus Rory McDonald. Only one relevant fight on the card. That being the main event, but there were some really entertaining fights. The UFC, again, they couldn't put together the most relevant fight night card for this. There's a lot of guys tied up that first week of July. So instead, they went the opposite direction with stuff that was designed to be as fan-friendly as possible, and they succeeded for the most part. There were some barn burners last night, so we're going to be talking about all of that. Plus any news that happens to kind of come up between now and then. I don't think there was a whole lot noteworthy that came out of the last week, but I've been wrong about that before. Anyway, back here with me this week. He was off last week. He was doing stuff at E3. He was working. He was covering stuff, meeting people, taking notes. His coverage is up of that event in the on 411 Mania. But he's back this week. 411's Wildcat in general and all around, you know, jack of all trades. Jeff Harris is back. How you doing, Jeff?
Good evening, Robert Winfrey. Once again, it is me, the J to the E to the double F-R-E, back from hanging out with Anderson Silva at E3 to talk to all of you.
All right. Yeah, for those of you who don't follow Jeff on various social media outlets. He did run into Anderson Silva. It was very nice picture. I was jealous. I was very jealous. Not going to lie.
Anderson doesn't know it yet, but we're besties now, Robert. Are you jealous?
I would only advise that you not listen to him regarding, you know, medications you might have to take, because you don't need the trouble that might cause.
Thank you for the suggestion.
Up first, last night, Stephen Thompson, Rory McDonald. I was psyched for this fight. It didn't play out exactly how I thought it would. There's a couple of reasons for that, and I want to get into those specifically in a minute or two. Stephen Thompson defeated Rory McDonald via unanimous decision, 250-45s and a 48-47. I had it 50-45. The 48-47, no. The first round could be close if you didn't understand that Stephen Thompson was scoring points. He comprehensively outstruck McDonald. There just was a bit of a feeling out process for that round. So his offense was a little bit more limited than it would be in later rounds, when things got a lot clearer. But if all you did was see Rory McDonald moving forward and discounted, you know, the body work that Thompson put in and the long range stuff, then okay, fine, you can be stupid like that. The third round was the other round that was somewhat close. And if you gave Rory the third round, I mean, again, I gave all of them to Stephen Thompson, but the third round was, I believe, the most competitive. Rounds 4 and 5 were not even close. Those were all Wonder Boy. So the 3-2 scoring, not a big fan of that particular scorecard, to be perfectly honest. That was borderline Canadian clucky right there. But this fight played out very differently than I expected in a couple of ways. One, I thought Rory McDonald would be much more aggressive than he was. Now, I knew he wouldn't be as wild and reckless as Johnny Hendricks was, not just because that particular path got Johnny Hendricks knocked out in the first round, but that's also not the type of fighter he is.
Okay, I can get to it around this way.
He's a lot more technical, both with movement and punching, than Johnny Hendricks is. And but he didn't pull the trigger as often as I thought he would. I thought he would be a lot more active, especially from range. McDonald fights long pretty well. He's got a good jab. He's got a good front kick to the body. He didn't use either of those all that much. And I know that they would have just been kind of trading those back and forth a little bit, and he didn't want to leave himself too vulnerable to counters, but he was, kind of shockingly passive for large stretches of this fight, and that's not when Rory McDonald's at his best. He tried to fight a very tactical game plan, and for the first three rounds, again, a couple of those, again, one, okay, I can kind of see you being stupid as a judge. Three, he could have legitimately won. Could have. The third round was, again, the closest. But once he started kind of breaking from that pattern, the differences between the two started to emerge. Anytime Rory got a bit linear, in his entrances to combinations or to try to close distance, Stephen Thompson was cracking him with two or three punches and finding an angle and just nowhere to be found. And the fourth and fifth rounds are a really good visual aid for how to, over time, continue to use angles properly for counter-striking. And Thompson was, when they were distance, I talked about it last week, Thompson is great at applying pressure from distance just with long kicks either to the body or leg, a long jab, maybe a kind of hopping power hand punch that just catches you off balance or keeps you thinking and forces you to respond to him even though he's the one at distance. And McDonald just really struggled with all that. His nose got broken again pretty badly, which sucks, but, you know, I mean, Robbie Lawler did a number on his face in their title fight, and some of that, you know, some stuff after it's surgically repaired can be stronger. Broken bones can certainly be stronger. Some stuff, if you mess up your hand, that can lead to, you know, a lifetime of hand issues. The face is one of those things that, you know, once it kind of starts going, subjecting it to further concussive impacts is, you know, it can be bad. So, I mean, I'm not sure how much that played into it, but if it did, Thompson's all-around game showed off here. He reversed a takedown in the fifth round to land in side control for a big stretch of it. Look, Thompson's the next champion. I mean, Robbie Lawler has enough power to knock him out. He can knock out pretty much anyone in that division. But Robbie can't match him technically. He can't match him in terms of speed. He can't match him in terms of movement. He can win that fight if it comes to it, and it probably will. I don't think Tyron Woodley beats Robbie Lawler. But I think Stephen Thompson's going to be champion, and I mean, this was not the type of fight I expected. It was a lot more tactical. It was still very interesting. I love tactical fights that aren't, I don't like boring fights, but fights where guys are making adjustments, doing things, reading each other, and even if they're slightly more minimalistic, and this was, again, not a barn burner, but a very tactical, very high-level fight, and I enjoy those. And if you don't, that's, you know, fine and dandy. I'm not here to tell you what to enjoy or what not to enjoy. And you know, seeing Stephen Thompson go all five rounds, looked good all five rounds. Yeah, I think he's the next champion. I'm throwing it out there right now. All right, Jeff, you were busy last week. You didn't get to preview the show with me. So what did you think was going to happen, and you know, especially relative to what actually did happen for this fight?
I'm not surprised the fight went this way. I think I'm not surprised at all by Rory McDonald's performance, because we've seen that from him many times before. We've seen him just show up and look completely flat and unimpressive. He did it against Jake Ellenberger. He did it against Robbie Lawler in their first fight. And he just has these performances where he's really flat, laid back, very gun shy, which he was last night, and very uninspired. His game plan last night looked abysmal. I didn't really see him make any adjustments until really in the fifth round, where he finally started opening up and, you know, trying to land punches on Stephen Thompson. Because look, as good as Stephen Thompson is at utilizing that karate, that side stance, that side karate stance, and fighting it at distance, finding his range, finding rhythm, and effectively and quickly landing kicks, just unorthodox dynamic kicks from weird angles and getting out of there before you can hit him. He leaves tons of openings, Robert, and you got to see that as well. He has his hands, the way he fights, he has his hands very low and his head is pretty much wide open, and he doesn't have a ton of head movement. And I feel like if Rory McDonald had actually tried to maybe close distance, maybe tried some clinch work, some dirty boxing maybe, or just maybe was tried to push the pace a little bit more, he would have had a lot more success in that fight. I mean, one judge was dumb enough to give him two rounds, as offensive as that was. So that means had he maybe put in a little more effort and just – it looked like he was honestly standing still, just standing still and let Thompson just work his game and let Thompson make it his fight. And that's ultimately what happened. And I like Stephen Thompson a lot. I love his style. He's very exciting to watch, but I don't think he's unbeatable either. And I think Robbie Lawler has a very good chance of beating him as well.
Well, having your hands down at your sides is one of those things that you never teach someone. It's like, I'm trying to think of an appropriate analogy. In any sport, for example.
Well, look, he was keeping his head away from danger most of the fight. But there were those times where he was getting hit. So the way I see it is, if you can get your punches or your strikes through those openings and land on him, which Rory did do in the fifth round, you can do some damage to Thompson, and you can possibly beat him that way. To me, it's not rocket science.
No, as far as, you know, if you put it on paper, it's not rockets. The issue becomes trying to execute it against a guy of his level, which is why you watch the fights, you know?
But, I mean, look, in McFeeta's heyday, which was 7 years ago now, we all thought he was going to be unbeatable. And then one fight into his title reign, he has a performance where he struggles against Shogun. I mean, it's not – no style is unbeatable. Just like Dominic Cruz, it's the same thing. He has a very difficult style that guys have trouble dealing with, but I see tons – when I watch his fights, I see tons of openings and I see tons of ways guys can exploit his style and find ways to win. And I see that with Thompson as well. As much as I like Thompson and enjoy watching him fight, and as much as I expected him to do exactly what he did last night, and Rory McDonald, you know, would look flat, and then he'd go back into his corner, and Vera Sahabi would probably tell him he's winning and he's doing fine without giving him any sense of urgency, which is exactly what happened as well. Am I wrong there?
No.
Terrible corner advice. Terrible.
I thought he was okay between rounds one and two because, again, round one, you're feeling things out. Good, you know, he didn't get, you know, there was not a lot of damage back and forth. But after that, when you see a guy like Thompson starting to, you know, comprehensively outpoint you, to outwork you, and nothing you're doing is working necessarily, you've got to be able to instill and communicate to your fighter an effective way. And cornering is tough. I mean, you have 60 seconds to find a way to effectively communicate with another human being and to potentially get across very important information. It's a difficult thing. I mean, and don't get me wrong, sometimes it's just outright bad. And sometimes it's sublime, but it's a very difficult thing to do. And again, it's a hobby, not so much in elements of this one.
I think the hobby is a good coach and a good trainer, but, you know, your fighter has to know that Rory is down going into the fifth. And I have to feel Rory believed it as well. And, I mean, I don't know. Just to say walking down, I mean, I don't know. I mean, maybe he's telling him something different and I'm just not understanding the code there. Maybe, you know, walk him down means, you know, maybe, you know, get close to him and knock him out. Maybe it means something like that. I have no idea. But I just, what I was hearing from Zahabi wasn't really benefiting Rory at all, is what it sounded like.
Yeah, I, walking someone down is it's good general advice, and it tends to lean heavily on your preparation. How you walk someone down is different. Like how you would try to walk down Stephen Thompson, for example, very different from how, as another point of reference, Fedor walked down Mirko Krokop in their title fight. That's what he did. Constantly pressed forward, didn't really let him angle, smothered him. Now, again, Krokop, very different type of striker, but the general advice for what that generally means is, as far as a strategy goes, is that, and it does lean heavily on how you've trained for it. So, again, you train to walk down Stephen Thompson as part of a strategy, and telling your fighter that, you know, we need to execute this better. He did. He most certainly did. He struggled in those fourth and fifth rounds to close distance effectively. He kind of resorted to, I mean, not quite bullying forward in the same way someone like Jake Ellenberger or Johnny Hendricks does, but he moved in very straight lines. And every time he did, he got tagged two or three times, and then, you know, Thompson hits an angle, and we're back to square one if you're Rory McDonald.
I mean, just to give you an example of some other bad cornering, I specifically remember when George St. Pierre fought Jake Shields, in between rounds, that, like, Shields is asking, I think, Gilbert Melendez, who was in his corner for that fight, should I take him to the round? And Gilbert Melendez is like, no. And then, oddly enough, most of that fight was fought standing up. And it was mystifying to me because I thought what made that matchup so interesting was that if one guy could possibly deal with George St. Pierre's MMA wrestling and grappling, it was a guy like Jake Shields. And Shields has never really had renowned striking. His striking has always really been his weakest area. And then for, you know, Melendez to essentially coach him to keep the fight standing, I can't see that at all. I feel like, if you're Jake Shields, you at least want to make some attempts to get George St. Pierre to the ground, because I think that's where you can possibly have an advantage over him, because your striking definitely isn't better than George St. Pierre's. So that's just one of those cases where I don't understand corner advice, and I don't understand what Fira Sahabi was doing with Rory here. And I don't know if it was the loss to Lawler and you know, still being scared about his nose or having his nose broken again. I feel like we've seen these performances out of Rory before. If he can't impose his will, if he can't impose his game, he's lost. And if a fighter's not, like, doing what he wants to do and engaging him, well, maybe not that. He just doesn't know what to do. He looked lost out there. He just looked gun-shy, and no matter what he says, he didn't look like he was performing at 100% last night, at least not mentally. Physically, he might have been in good shape, but mentally, he definitely was not, no matter what he says in the post-fight presser.
No, he clearly had some trouble making in-cage adjustments to Stephen Thompson, and against a guy like Thompson, that's very important. I'll tell you, one of the things that surprised me about this was how effective Thompson was in the clinch. He out-grappled Rory McDonald from the clinch more than once.
Yeah, and he had, when Rory went in for a takedown, he got on top of Rory and had him in like full side mount in the fifth. After Rory started opening up with punches and started punching him a little bit, it was almost getting an advantage there.
Some of the improvements Stephen Thompson made from, you know, the Hendricks fight to this fight kind of surprised me.
And one thing Rory was doing in this fight, he made multiple attempts at a heel hook using, what did they call it, a Kaminari roll?
Imanari roll.
Imanari roll. So he made multiple attempts for that rolling heel hook. And Thompson was easily able to defend it and slip out of it multiple times. So how many times? I feel like Rory attempted that at least three times, right?
Three or four off the top of my head.
I mean, attempting it that many times, okay, I can maybe understand you want to test the guy's maybe submission defense, submission skills, but to attempt it that, to exert that much energy on sort of a technique you're failing at, that I don't understand either.
No, I mean, the first one I liked because, we tend to think of McDonald as a very conventional fighter. Not that he's not, a very, very good fighter, but conventional in a lot of ways. So throwing something unexpected out there against Stephen Thompson, I thought was very good, very intelligent. But then
I feel
the
like
subsequent
in
attempt.
In any fight, if you're gonna keep repeating a technique and you keep repeating it and you're not having any success with it, I'm like, why are you even doing that?
Yeah,
so
I had
weird.
The same. I had that exact same reaction, not just to this fight, but to a fight on the same card a little bit earlier. Steve Bossy missed, I felt like, a full dozen spinning back fists against Sean O'Connell. And just kind of made me, that same kind of roll. What are you doing, man?
I mean, like, the first attempt, yeah, it's cool. It's cool to see him, try and bust something out like that. Especially for a guy like Rory McDonald, who we don't see, make those kind of attempts. But then, just went to the well one too many times. Whatever.
Yeah. Again, I enjoyed the fight a lot, but I was very engaged and very interested in what was going on in the adjustments and the decisions that both guys were making in the cage.
I mean, I know some fans weren't happy with the fight last night. I liked the fight. I enjoyed it from a technical standpoint. I just didn't like the way Rory performed, and I just didn't like what I was hearing from his corner.
Yeah, Rory, I mean, on the one hand, I feel bad for him because coming off of a long layoff, including a surgical reconstruction of part of your body, in his case, parts of his face, to come back against a guy like Stephen Thompson, that's a big ask. By the same token, the fact that he never – I mean, the only effective offense he managed to get was striking in the pocket, and the reality of those exchanges was, while he was landing, he was getting outstruck in the pocket too. He was able to land there, which is better than, missing at range, but he got hit, again, 2-3 times for every one he landed. And that was an area, I mean, I was way off. I thought he'd have a substantial advantage if he could get, even just, again, striking in that boxing kind of pocket distance, I thought he'd have an advantage over Thompson. And if he did, it was not in evidence last night.
I feel bad for Rory in the sense that I feel he's really just been overhyped for most of his career. And I think it was really dangerous for him when people started anointing him as like GSP's successor. And how can you ever live up to those types of expectations? Now, I mean, Rory has plenty of time, to make adjustments and still, make go on a run and go on an impressive comeback. Hell, look at Michael Bisping. It took him 10 years. And
a couple of strokes of luck.
Yeah, strokes of luck, tons of fights. He got a detached retina. He has oil in his eye. his eye looks totally jacked, and finally wins the title. I mean, so there you go. It takes, this doesn't have to be the end of Rory's story, but at the same time, I think it was just so dangerous to hype this kid because he came into the UFC as a teenager, a very bright, promising teenager, but a teenager nonetheless. So he's essentially had to grow up.
Wasn't his second fight against Carlos Condit?
His second UFC fight, not his second fight overall.
Yeah, his second UFC fight against Carlos Condit. That's insane.
And he's handled it, and I think he's handled everything remarkably well. I think, you know, but still, to put all that on a young guy like him, I think is just, it's just bad news, and it's been bad news for his career in the long term.
Yeah, he was never going to live up to being the next GSP. I mean, it's an unrealistic expectation to place on him, and quite frankly, it's a bit of an insult to just how special someone like GSP is.
Right, and I'm not saying that Rory
but,
is special.
You know, go ahead. Because I'm going to segue into my next point.
It's not that Rory isn't special. He's a very good, he's a talented fighter. He's one of the, he's legitimately a top 10 welterweight. It's just that
I still think he's top 5, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I guess it just depends on how you see the ranking and how you want to determine the rankings. But it's just so, how do you live up to something like that? I mean, it's impossible.
Yeah.
GSP he's one of the greatest of all time. He had an unheralded, almost unparalleled run, except maybe John Jones and Anderson Silva. And I think it's good to have long-term goals with a fighter like him, but to put all that on him, I just don't think it helped him at all, because each time out, you're expecting him to do something spectacular. And then there were many fights where he just didn't deliver and he had kind of off performances. Even performances he won, like against BJ Penn and Jake Ellenberger, where you left those fights just feeling, man, I expected Rory to do something different or something more. So I feel bad for him in that sense. And now that he's in his free agency period, I hope it works out for him. I hope he stays in the UFC. I know he and his girlfriend are having a child. So, I mean, I hope it works out for him. I hope he gets what he wants and gets paid more, but we'll see.
Yeah, I'm with you on his free agency. I mean, he's in a rough spot, you know, on a 2-fight losing streak. I mean, granted, those are the two best welterweights on the planet, but still, it's a rough spot from a negotiating standpoint.
One of those losses was one of the best. It was one of the best fights ever. You know, it was a tremendous, you know, fight of the year candidate performance. And, you know, this fight, less than spectacular, but it was arguably a title eliminator fight as well. I mean, from just depending, you could have put Rory back in that slot depending on look, Tyron Woodley is fighting Robbie Lawler, and Rory has a win over Tyron Woodley. So there you go.
Yeah, I maintain the winner of this fight, whoever it was going to get the next title shot. I mean, you could sell a rematch with Lawler easily based on the quality
of
that first title fight.
Or Damian Maia for that. Or maybe if you want Damian Maia for that matter, but whatever. I'm sorry, Damian Maia, you're not the top contender.
I like Damian Maia, but I mean, we're talking about – and especially since Stephen Thompson won, I think Maia's going to need one more win. Or to sit out for longer than he wants to.
Thompson has the winning streak. He knocked out the former champion in the first round. He beat a former title contender. He's the next contender for the title, and I want to see that fight so bad.
I mean, look, Stephen Thompson may not have finished Rory, but on the whole, he did much better against McDonald than Robbie Lawler did.
Maybe, but
Lawler lost three of those first four rounds pretty decisively.
What I like about Thompson, though, here's what I do like about Thompson, is that he has a, you know, it's not often where you see like a specialist fighter who has like the specific discipline and adapts it to MMA and adapts it very well and makes a very effective use of it like Stephen Thompson does. And that's why I'm so excited about the prospect of him fighting for the title. And I really, really hope that fight gets booked next. That's the fight I want. And I was there live for Thompson's UFC debut, which was, and I was pretty impressed with him that night as well. I thought, man, this, you know, it's cool to see a karate guy who can use karate well in MMA. And it's very exciting. So, and he's done very well for himself. And he's proven himself against top-level fighters, against top-five fighters, and against wrestlers. I mean, that's the big thing. A striker like Thompson compete against a wrestler, and he proved that against Johnny Hendricks. So there you go.
Yeah, I mean, two of his last three wins have been against predominantly wrestlers. Both Jake Ellenberger and Johnny Hendricks are wrestlers by trade. And, you know, Rory McDonald's takedown offense, his top game is very good, and none of them could get that going against Thompson. Give him the next title shot. I'll go so far as to say I don't even care if there's a bad decision when Lawler fights Woodley. I don't care.
It's all...
Give it to Stephen Thompson. He fights for the belt
next. It's very possible decision out of that fight, too.
And I hate to even put it out there, but it is. All right. Again, that was the main event. Really, really good good fight. I mean, not the barn burner that some of the other fights on this card were, but from a tactical standpoint, easily the most interesting. All right, co-main event. Donald Cerrone, the old cowboy, defeated Patrick Cote via TKO in the third round. Donald Cerrone is the first man to stop Patrick Cote with strikes. Think about the cage, about some of the other men Cote has faced.
Yeah, Anderson Silva didn't stop him with strikes.
Nope, he injured his knee. Tito Ortiz, when Tito was in his prime, Cote fought for the light heavyweight belt back then. I mean, he has been in the cage with some Stephen Thompson, actually, since I was just talking about him. Cote lost to Stephen Thompson, but that was a decision. Donald Cerrone TKO'd Patrick Cote in the third round. Donald Cerrone is a bad, bad man. Two things about this fight relative to some of my predictions. One, I knew Cerrone was taller than Patrick Cote. I did not expect but I still felt Cote was the bigger man, especially kind of through the torso. Cote's a fairly thickly built guy. I was really surprised come fight night at the lack of size differential there. Again, I knew Cerrone would be taller and longer, but I thought Cote would be, again, a little bit more muscled. It's weird to say that someone who is not taller is physically bigger, but I expected Cote to be the physically bigger man, and he wasn't. Really surprised me when I saw them, you know, get in the cage together. Oh, well, there go elements of my prediction. Cerrone mixing in his takedowns very well. He's got a good offensive takedown game when he chooses to use it. Hard leg kicks. He just beat up Patrick Cote everywhere. This was all Donald Cerrone all the time. Might as well have been a sparring session. The guy came out in the first round and was just... because Cerrone's been a slow starter in the past. Not tonight. There were a couple of traditionally slow starters from this card who decided that in this particular day they were just, no, we're not coming out like we're stuck in cement. We're going to come out guns a-blazing. Really one-sided from Donald Cerrone, who remains undefeated at welterweight. I could even see him cracking the top 15 at welterweight at this particular point. Really fan-friendly affair, and Donald Cerrone continues to be awesome. And he said in his last fight out, if you want to get hurt, he knows a guy. So, great outing from the Cowboy, Jeff.
Cowboy is my favorite fighter in the UFC, and I feel like I've made that clear before. And last night was no exception. But then again, this is sort of the scenario where Cerrone tends to excel. It's just the big, meaningful fights where it's either a title eliminator or the title is on the line where he tends to fall apart and mentally doesn't show up. And this was a fight I knew Cerrone could win. Cote is a good fighter. He's a good striker. He's been having a very good run. Considering his age and time in the sport, he's been looking good lately. But Cerrone has always been well-rounded. He's always been a hard hitter. He's always been had great, grappling. And he showed all those aspects off in his game last night. I mean, he almost choked Cote out midway through before eventually stopping him. It was good to see him be the aggressor for once in this fight. I mean, he's had aggressive performances before, but none quite like this. I think it's nice to see fighters, not killing themselves to make weight, and then maybe it takes a toll on their performance later. And I think maybe that was starting to happen, not just with guys like Robert Whittaker, but maybe guys like Cerrone as well, who cuts a lot of weight, and it's hell on him in order to make 155. Cerrone, I think there was always this thought that he could maybe be a decent welterweight because he's a pretty big, tall, and long lightweight. And I think he's doing well for himself at welterweight, and I think he should stick with it for right now. Unless there's a big fight, I know he was talking about Khabib Nurmagomedov last night, but it just doesn't seem realistic at the moment. I guess unless there's that big fight for him there that he really wants at lightweight, he's going to stick welterweight right now. And honestly, I have no problem with that. I feel like he's doing great at welterweight, and maybe if he runs into a couple of opponents that maybe 155 is a better fit for him. But I mean, honestly, he looks, arguably he might be even better as a welterweight than he was as a lightweight Winfrey. And that's scary to think about. He was consistently one of the top lightweights in the UFC for the past several years.
Yeah. Had a massive winning streak going. I mean, the only guy he's lost to in the last 3 years or so, I think, is Rafael Dos Anjos. I mean, who is the champion? Yeah, he was a very good, very consistent lightweight, and I agree, he might be better at welterweight. We've got to see him against a really big welterweight next before we can make a better determination, but so far, so good. I have one request out of life at this point, pertaining to Donald Cerrone at this point. Well, just one. Now, let me say, before I verbalize this, I am well aware this can never happen. I am intellectually aware of this. I don't care. And I don't care what maybe hoops we have to jump through, where we have to go to make it happen. I want Mark Hunt to fight Donald Cerrone.
That would be crazy.
I mean, here's the thing. They would both do it. Donald Cerrone doesn't care. Mark Hunt doesn't care. They love to fight. They love to knock people out. And again, massive weight discrepancy to the tune of 100 pounds for Mark Hunt, probably. I know that it's unlikely to get sanctioned, maybe outside of Texas. Texas might, just as a thought. But again, I don't care. I want to watch those two guys who just they don't care. They love to fight and just watch them hit each other. I mean, Donald Cerrone's probably going down very quickly. I don't care because there's also an outside chance he sticks and moves and is able to kind of, chop down Mark Hunt, maybe get him into a grappling fest where Cerrone will be better. I don't care. I want to watch Donald Cerrone fight Mark Hunt, and I know it will never happen, but I'm putting it out there. That's what I want out of life at this particular point in time.
I hope your dream comes true at some point, Robert.
And let's be clear, not only would they both sign on the dotted line for that fight, you know people would pay to watch it. Not just because it's a freak show fight either. Those are two skillful fighters, and people would love to pay to watch that fight happen. Just throwing it out there, because somebody has to. All right. Anything else on that fight, Jeff? Are we good to move on to Bossy and O'Connell?
I'm good to move on.
All right. Featured bout of the evening, Steve Bosse defeated Sean O'Connell via unanimous decision. 29-28, 29-28, and 29-27. I disagree rather firmly with the 29-27. I know it would have come in the second round. I don't care. It's still wrong. If you didn't give O'Connell a 10-8 for nearly finishing Bosse with strikes in the first, you should not give Bosse a 10-8 in the second for being inside control for a fair chunk of that round. Just there's an inequity of scoring there that is somewhat bothering. I actually scored this fight for Sean O'Connell. I gave him rounds 1 and 3. 3 being the determining round. But look, this fight was designed to be two guys punching each other in the face. And this fight was two guys punching each other in the face. We got exactly what was advertised here. Again, I disagree with the decision. On the flip side, I can only be so mad at it because it came down to one round, realistically, that being the third. The third, they both hit each other a lot. I can sort of see the argument for Bossy. Fine. Again, we all were entertained by this, so I'm not going to complain about the decision too much. Nothing of relevance happened. Neither of these guys is really going anywhere. But everyone was entertained. Punches were thrown. Blood was spilled. Fun was had by all. I'm not going to be that grouchy about it. Jeff, we had a couple of unranked, you know, filler fighters here. But, man, they had probably the most entertaining fight of the night, all things considered.
It was what it was.
Yeah, very true. All right. At lightweight, Olivier Aubin-Mercier defeated Thibaut Gotti via submission in the third round, rear naked choke. A real brief aside, this event had 6. Six third round finishes. That is a UFC record for most fights finished in the third round on a single card. Nice to see guys still going for it in the third. A lot of times you get to that third round, people are kind of coasting a little bit. Nice to see guys still going for it. This was designed as a showcase for Aubin-Mercier, who could just against a guy who could just out-grapple. And he did. He choked him out. He did his job. He's a young guy, but he's someone the UFC wants to keep relevant because he's Canadian and they want to keep that marketplace good and going. And he's good looking kid. He's generally winning. Still, you know, he's still got some areas to develop his game in, but you know, so does 90% of the roster. That's not really an insult. Good rebound win after his first loss. So not a whole lot to say here. Jeff, you got anything different on the old Quebec kid there?
Good performance by Aubin Mercier. Nothing really surprising. He got the finish. He looked good. So no complaints for me.
All right. The first ever women's flyweight fight occurred. There are, to the best of my knowledge, no plans to institute a permanent flyweight division for the women, which really makes sense. They'd be cannibalizing the smaller end of bantamweight and people who maybe just didn't want to cut for strawweight. You'd be cutting into two other divisions that are still growing.
Still developing.
Yeah, still developing, especially strawweight in a lot of ways.
I am not at all against a 125-pound women's division. I just think, you know, you have to build these two other divisions up more and make sure, you know, they're established and they have some depth before you start another one.
Yeah. That being said, if they have a few flyweight fights here or there to kind of get the idea of the division going, maybe see how different women look if they you know, either make that extra cut or cut less weight, as the case may be, I'm fine with that too. That's okay with me.
Well, I mean, this fight was primarily held at 125 because Valerie Letourneau practically killed herself to make strawweight to fight Joanna Jędrzejczyk. It didn't go well for her, but cutting down to 125 didn't go so well for her either. So I don't know what she's going to do.
Apparently she's moving back up to bantamweight, which is fine. She just she was defeated via TKO in the third round.
Here's my problem with that. Before this fight, she said she's not big enough to be a bantamweight, is what she said. So that's her own words.
She said that, and she's somewhat correct. She is a tad undersized at bantamweight. But apparently, again, the strawweight cut took a lot out of her. I mean, I think from a body frame standpoint, 125 is somewhat ideal. Unfortunately, she ran into a bit of a wrecking machine here in Joanne Calderwood.
My girl, JoJo.
I don't know what happened to the real Joanne Calderwood, and I just don't. But this cyborg they replaced her with for this fight is certainly money. Because this version of Joanne Calderwood looks nothing like any of her previous UFC fights. I didn't watch the season of The Ultimate Fighter that she was on because I don't care about Tough at all. For the last decade. Don't care. But, yeah, there was a lot of discussion, a lot of hype around her. And, you know, she struggled a little bit in the UFC. Now, some of that's to be expected. All things considered, you're making adjustments. You're fighting in a bigger cage, on a bigger stage. You're running into maybe a different class of fighter than you were used to on it, the other circuits. I mean, again, there's all kinds of reasons why people with hype don't always live up to it immediately upon entering the UFC. And that's fine and dandy.
She was apparently also going through some difficulties in her personal life, apparently. So there was that as well. I'm not trying to make excuses for her, but this game is really tough on you mentally. It is abhorrent on your mental state. It will really stress you out. So that stress can get to some fighters sometimes.
Yeah. There are things outside the cage that play into your performance just as heavily. And when you hit it big and you start getting in the UFC, you know, things like that in your personal life and your personal relationships and whatnot can crop up in ways you didn't foresee. Anyway, the point is, all kinds of reasons, and some people can shake it off and start capitalizing on that, and some people can't. I had kind of resigned myself to the fact that Joanne Calderwood was going to be a good top 15 strawweight, who just, might never crack the top 5 or get to title contention, but was always going to be, kind of good for a fight, and a good filler for the division. That's just kind of where I had her pegged at this point. And then she comes out last night and just runs over Valerie Letourneau. Drops her with a spinning back fist in the first round. That fight, it could have been stopped.
Practically had her doubled over from a kick to the body.
Yeah, wrecked Letourneau's body with, again, front kicks and knees specifically.
I mean,
I need to yell at the referee.
She practically abused Letourneau last night.
Yeah, and I tend to, again, I'm not the biggest fan of Valerie Letourneau, but she just got worked by Joanne Calderwood. And again, just where is, again, all those things conspiring, fine. This version of Joanne Calderwood, I suddenly get it. It's like, oh, this is the person you all were watching and saying, hey, she could be a top contender. She might even hold the belt. I see it now.
We'll see.
You are correct.
We'll see. I loved her performance last night, and I mean, obviously, I like her a lot, and I think she has a voice that could stop a vicious, rabid, wild animal in its tracks. But I'm still not convinced, you know, just this fight alone, she's turned everything around, and she's, you know, on a warpath back to title contention. I want to see that, obviously, and I want to see her get to that level. But I want to see her – it's about consistency. I want to see her – I want to see this Joanne Calderwood, and I want to see her do this again against a higher-level opponent. And Valerie Letourneau is good, and she put in a good performance in her – she put in a good showing in her title fight, but this was still a catchweight fight. And I'm not going to say like it wasn't real or it didn't mean anything. I mean, for Joanne to come back and look that good, I mean, very important for her. But now is where I feel like the real work is going to begin for her, and I want to see her this razor sharp and this focused in her next fight, hopefully. And I think if she does, it'll be outstanding.
Yeah, I agree with you about consistency. You know, anyone can look good on any one night, but if she can maintain that form, yeah, she's not just place filler. She's legitimate, and you know, one of the top, you know, potentially one of the best in the world. All right, before we move on from this fight, I need to yell at the referee here.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, two things, one of which I can only blame him partially for because I'm not sure what the institutional standards are. Valerie Letourneau in the second round had some kind of an issue with her top. I don't know if it was the sports bra or something. She had a pretty serious issue. Now, she didn't fall out of her top, but it was visible that there was something going on. Now, in order to prevent, you know, a massive display of herself, she had to kind of drop her guard and try to fix this issue. Now, if you're the referee, and now here's my gripe. The referee did nothing during this. There was a lot of confusion about him potentially. Is he stepping in to stop the fight? Because some of the precipitating factors there, you know, she got hit in the body a few times and that, you know, clearly tweaked some things. Letourneau was, she got hit again. She kind of got hit a few times. Some of that was because she wound up dropping her guard, but she then got hit because she dropped her guard. And the referee kind of stepped in, and there was a lot of confusion about, you know, is he potentially stopping the fight? Because again, she got hit a few times and those were clean shots. Valerie was kind of trying to explain what was going on, and there was a lot of confusion. Let me be clear. Now, also, Valerie Letourneau was not the first woman under the Reebok uniform policy to have issues with the upper part of the uniform. In fact, one of the first female fights after that policy was instituted had a massive the whole, like, top of the uniform displaced massively towards the right. It was – I forget the fight, so I can't cite it, but I was covering it. It was on Fight Pass. The UFC should be very grateful. It was on Fight Pass and not on either pay-per-view or, God help them, on Fox. This is not an isolated incident. Other women have had problems of this similar nature. This is an equipment malfunction, by definition. If you're the referee, your job is to call time, let it get sorted out. The same thing that happens if someone loses a mouthpiece or tape starts flying off of their hands or you have issues with your shorts, which has happened in the past as well, mind you. You need to be, as the official, it is your job to take control of that situation, make sure everyone understands equipment malfunction. I'm going to have a brief time here and we're going to sort it out and then we're going to get back. The confusion around that situation was unnecessary and falls entirely at the feet of the referee for not controlling it. The finish. I have to yell about this. Now, part of this is, and somebody brought this up in the comments section. I want to address what he brought up because it's relevant. Valerie Letourneau gets hit with a wicked front kick into the floating ribs. Those hurt. Those hurt a lot. I've been hit there in the
past. It didn't even look that hard from the video, but it clearly hurt.
Well, again, when you hit the floating ribs, especially if they've been damaged, you don't need to land flush to really kind of, especially for a pain reaction, which is what
She probably worked over that area before that closing sequence as well, right?
Yeah. Oh, she got hurt to that same spot in the second round, I think. Had kind of the same reaction, just kind of doubling over. And again, I understand. I bring this up because you get hit there, it sucks. If you're not expecting it, if you're already hurt there, she doubles over and turns her back on Joanne Calderwood. Now, Letourneau has kind of a bad habit of turning away when she gets hurt. She did the same thing against Joanna. Again, earlier in this fight it happened. It's a bad habit. Now, you should never turn your back on your opponent. I mean, it's just, if you have any ability to control it, it's the worst thing you can do. If you choose to do that, you're opening yourself up to all kinds of offense. That's on her. That was a decision and a choice that she made in the instance of being hurt that I'm going to turn away from this person who is attacking me. That's on her, and I am perfectly willing to give her that. If you do that, and
for many normal people, Robert, that would probably be an instinctual reaction in many ways.
It is. It really is, because you don't want to get hit in the face. You're trying to protect elements of you that are very sensitive. I understand, and I'm not criticizing her necessarily for having that reaction. Plenty of tough fighters have. My point is simply, if you do that, you open yourself up to offense, and that's on you.
I agree.
The fact that this was the – and here's why I have to yell at the referee. The fact that this was the third time she had been visibly hurt, dropped in the first with a spinning back fist, crumpled over in the second from a body kick, this was the third one. An isolated incident. Look, there was a rule in Pride, and it was a silly rule in many ways, that if you turned your back on your opponent, you were basically submitting. And that's true in some ways. It constitutes a bit of a submission. Now, not the same as tapping out verbally or physically. And again, there were some issues with it in Pride about especially selective enforcement. But it exists for a reason, because if you turn your back on your opponent, you are signaling that you are not in a position to defend the best, that you kind of want out for whatever reason. And again, if you're beat down physically, fine. You know, and you choose that, that's fine. I'm not criticizing anyone here, except the referee, because he saw that. He saw Valerie Letourneau get hit in the body, saw her double over and turn completely around from Joanne Calderwood for, again, the third time, badly hurt in this fight, and he decided that, I think she wants to fight. I'm not going to stop this fight. I can't get mad at Joanne Calderwood for punching someone when the referee has not told you, is saying, keep fighting.
The referee was telling Valerie to keep fighting in that instance.
Yes. And look, he allowed Valerie Letourneau to get hit two or three times more than is necessary, including being knocked down before he stopped it. This was terrible. This was absolutely terrible.
As you pointed out, Robert, this was like the third instance where this happened.
Yeah, I mean, first time, fine. Give him a chance to recover. The third, we have a demonstrated pattern here. We have a fighter who has been hit, hurt, rocked. And the fact that she didn't just turn and try to re-engage, she turned and actually walked towards the other side of the cage. She was done. And observing all of this evidence, your response was, well, she needs to get hit again. And again, and then another spinning back fist before I will finally stop this. This was egregious. This was terrible. You should be ashamed of yourself. If I'm a fighter, I would not feel comfortable with this guy. I believe it was Jaron Villel. I would not feel comfortable with him officiating my fights. Zero confidence in his ability to defend me as a fighter if a fight needs to be stopped. This was
I think
the worst job of officiating I have seen since Jason Herzog decided it was a good idea to allow Jamie Varner to fight on one leg. Terrible. Absolutely terrible.
We see it happen sometimes, and I think there are just more than I would care to remember. There are just instances where I feel like the referee is just not really in control of what's happening in the cage, and I just think is too – I think it's one thing to have leniency if a fighter gets hurt. If a fighter gets stunned and maybe knocked down, and being lenient and giving them a bit of a chance to recover. I think that's there's a thin line. There is a thin line, and it's a tough job. I admit that, but I feel like last night that referee was not in control of what was going on inside the cage. And just didn't have a good grasp of what was going on, because, as you said, what happened at the end was not an isolated instance. It was basically the third instance. And I feel like after the second, you know, you're either stopping it already or you're going over and saying, you know, if this happens, you know, you got to do something or I'm going to stop the fight. I just don't know. I don't know how he could allow it. He definitely allowed it to go too far, and I don't know how he could have allowed that. But unfortunately, it happens in the sport more times than I would care to admit. As far as I know, Valerie Letourneau was released from the hospital earlier today. She was not diagnosed with any serious injuries, but, I mean, honestly, who knows? She had her liver scanned and checked. Her liver is apparently okay. So, other than bumps and bruises, she didn't walk away with any serious injury or bone breaks. But, I mean, later down the line, you know, with all that wear and tear, who knows? But, I mean, I think we got lucky in that case. And I think that's why we have to scrutinize these officials way more, and why I feel like there needs to be either, like, demerits or there needs to be a punishment system in place. If a referee, I feel like, universally makes these mistakes, a referee, I think, should be put under review, and a decision, I think, needs to be made if they're going to be allowed to continue officiating fights. I don't see the problem in that either, Robert.
I don't either. I mean, look, in any other professional sport, there are levels to the officiating, the referees. You know, the NBA, the NFL, NHL, all of them. There are professional referees that work the big games because they are the best. I mean, Jeff, you remember a few years back when the NFL referees went on strike?
Yeah.
To continue with the season, the NFL just promoted a bunch of guys who do lower level football, and it was hilarious. It was hilariously bad. I don't even care that much about football. I watched because it was hilarious. And that's the kind of thing we need in MMA. We need to, you know, establish a class of referees that are the best and that consistently work the best shows with the best fighters. This is the same guy who thought Drew Dober was unconscious in that crappy guillotine from Leandro Silva. I mean, this is a guy we have now a bit of a pattern with.
I mean, it's unfortunate, at least as I recall, that fight result was overturned, correct?
It was turned into a no contest. That's correct.
Yeah. So the right decision was made there. So, I think we need a standard in place to create a standard of refereeing. Like the NFL, but I think the problem is there's not as much incentive to become a referee in MMA, even if you're refereeing for UFC events and whatnot, because it's a pretty thankless job. I don't know what NFL referees are making, though, but, I mean, it's going to be tough, and it might take years. This is just one of the unfortunate growing pains of the sport, just like the judging. I feel like we still have problems with judging. I mean, last night's event, we had one judge, candidate or not, for one judge, I think, to give two rounds to Rory McDonald literally offends me. It makes me gag. Just gag and wince. So I feel refereeing is in a very similar state. While there are some good referees, and, you know, Herb Dean makes mistakes, but whatever. Hopefully it can
get
fixed.
Well, I mean, one of the things – I mean, you mentioned earlier that refereeing is both a thankless and a difficult job, and it is. And it's one of the reasons I try not to lay into referees unless I feel there's a major issue, because I know it's thankless. I know it's difficult to make those split second decisions and then have them scrutinized by, you know, thousands of people, if not millions of people, with the benefit of instant replay that you don't have at the moment as you're making a decision. I understand, and it's one of the reasons, again, I try not to be too hard on referees. It's one of the reasons that when I do feel compelled to kind of go after them, it's something like this, where this was not a difficult decision. You had all the information right there, and somehow you still managed to botch it. That's what I find unacceptable.
Well, I'll say this much. I can't remember the last time we saw Steve Mazzagatti inside a UFC cage.
Finally.
No,
yeah, how long did it take for that change to finally come about?
Well, I think it really started happening after the NSAC got a new executive director. And then we got John McCarthy back in Nevada and such and such. But, look, I have no problem with Steve Mazzagatti as a person, but as a referee, you know, he just had a habit of very inconsistent calls. And I think everyone knew that.
Yeah.
Just like everyone knows Cecil Peoples, you know, and his horrendous judging record. I mean, it's obvious.
Yeah, agreed. Anyway, it was a good win for Calderwood, and apart from that egregious non-stoppage, that's so bad. It was a good way to kick off the main card. And we were kind of lucky this fight made the Fox Sports 1 broadcast, because they got preempted to finish out a NASCAR truck race. So they opened it on Fox Sports 2.
Yeah, I wish I had a little more warning about that freaking NASCAR thing. I had no idea it was on. No offense to NASCAR fans in it. Well, maybe I do mean offense, but damn.
I don't have anything against auto racing. It's just when I want to see a fight, I want to see a fight, not we're stopped
right.
Or we're not under red flag conditions because of liquid on the track.
I don't know. I feel like if it's going to be like that, I feel like they need to plan that out a little better, because this is like a first run UFC fight night card. It's not, you know, this isn't like the Fuel TV days where, you know, we're getting the lesser Fuel TV card. This is the FS1 UFC fight night, and it's hosting like a big title eliminator. So yeah, I'm a little annoyed about that. I'd be lying if I said I wasn't.
Yeah, I agree. All right. On the prelims, we had some good fights. Jason Sago defeated Leandro Silva via split decision, 229-28 for Sago, 129-28 for Silva. Not a whole lot here, but a relatively engaging fight. Certainly not the worst fight of the night. At light heavyweight, Misha, the old jawbreaker Serkunov, defeated Iwan Kutelaba via arm triangle in the third round. This was a pretty good fight. These two were throwing some leather. Misha Serkunov has a very, very, very good grappling game. I don't know if it gets the appreciation it deserves necessarily, so I'm bringing it up. Unfortunately, his takedowns are not good. He really needs to work on that aspect of his game. Once it's on the mat, he is. The way he set up that choke, hopped all the way over from side control to side control on the other side to get the choke. He tried to throw in the first round. Kutelaba wound up in full mount, and within 3 seconds, Sirkunov had kind of bucked him off and regained his feet. I mean, the man's grappling is good. Again, very good. He just, his takedowns are poor. He really needs to work on that. And they both threw some heavy lather. They had some fun striking exchanges. Kutalaba, someone to kind of, you know, light heavyweight needs bodies. And he's an entertaining fighter. Sirkunov should be ranked in the top 15 after this. And he's, again, about as close to a prospect. He and Corey Anderson, I think, are basically it for the division in terms of prospects. But another good fight, another good
win. Isn't there another Russian? There's another Russian fighter. I think he's been doing well lately at light heavyweight too, right? He used to be at heavyweight. What was his name?
I'd have to double check. I don't know. If you're thinking about heavyweight, I believe it's either Ruslan or Rashid Magomedov that fights up there, and I think it's Ruslan. And Sirkunov is Latvian anyway.
Right.
Middleweight, Christoph Yatko knocked the stuffing out of Tandon McCrory in the first round.
Oh, Krylov. It's Krylov. He's doing good as a light heavyweight.
Oh, yeah, he's Ukrainian. Yeah, okay. Yeah, Nikita Krylov.
Okay. Same thing.
are not the same thing, but...
I was kidding.
Well, you know, Putin wants them to be the same thing again, but... Politics aside.
Krylov has been doing very well as a light heavyweight, and he's a guy we have... He's a guy who could be, you know, rising through the ranks soon. So he's another one.
Yeah. Yeah. Krylov does deserve mention in that same kind of category. Anyway, Christoph Yatko knocked Tandon McCrory stupid. McCrory lost math. This was a wicked left. Look, I think I can't remember if I picked Yatko or McCrory from last week's show. Yatko's a tad underappreciated as a middleweight fight. He's unbeaten in the UFC, I think. If he's not, he's only lost one. Yeah, he lost to Magnus Siebenblatt. He's pretty darn good himself. Yatko's someone to keep an eye on. That kid's pretty good. At bantamweight, Joe Soto defeated Chris Beal via submission, rear naked choke in the third round. Good to see Chris Beal back at bantamweight. He clearly lost too much in that cut to flyweight. Looked a lot better in this fight. Joe Soto's grappling is very good. I don't know if it gets the appreciation or the recognition it deserves. Soto went to the finals of the 5th Eddie Bravo Invitational, if memory serves. He's a good grappler, and once he got Chris Beal's back, he just kept working for that choke. This is 3 in a row for Beal that he's lost. I think he'll stick around again. He looked pretty good. Hopefully he can learn from this, kind of settle down a little bit, not punch himself out as much. And Joe Soto finally gets the old monkey off his back and got a UFC win. On Fight Pass, Elias Theodoru defeated Sam Alvey via unanimous decision, 29-28 and 230-27s. I actually scored this fight for Sam Alvey. Theodoru frustrated me to no end in this fight, and then Sam Alvey did himself very few favors. It probably should have gone to Theodoru, but giving Theodoru the second round, I believe, was just flat out wrong. He just did nothing. He may as well have been shadow boxing, and Sam Alvey threw less than like 20 strikes through the first two rounds. Bizarre fight. At a catchweight fight, because Randa Markos missed weight, Randa Markos defeated Jocelyn Jones-Liebarger via unanimous decision, 30-27 and 229-28. I have no issue with Markos winning. The 30-27 was dubious. I thought Jones-Liebarger had, I believe it was the third, might have been the second, one of those two. At welterweight, Colby Covington defeated Jonathan Minor via submission in the third round, rear naked choke. Colby Covington is a good wrestler and a pretty good grappler, and if you can't stop him, you're going to lose, and Minor couldn't stop him. And kicking off the entire night, we had a really good flyweight fight. Ali Bagautinov defeated Gian Herrera via unanimous decision, 330-27s. I actually gave Herrera the third round. He had two good submission attempts, including a Kimura that I don't know how Baga Utinov did not tap out to that. His hand was touching the back of his head. I mean, it was insane, and somehow he techniqued his way out of it. It was good to see Baga Utinov kind of return to form. This is the guy I kind of became a fan of going into his fight with Demetrius Johnson. Really exceptional grappling, good punching, good power, aggressive fighter. It was nice to kind of get that bad taste out of my mouth that was the fight between Baga Utinov and Joseph Benavidez, because boy did that thing underdeliver. All right. Jeff, those were our set of prelims there. Any burning desires, anything you want to talk about?
Really impressive win by Christophe Jaco. I was really impressed by Baga Utinov's Kimura escape, juice or not, blood doping or not. Happy for Joe Soto getting his first UFC win over a tough opponent. So, yeah, there were some good fights up and down.
All right. I'd like to thank everyone who stopped by and kind of followed along in the comments section. I know Chip McFetters was there. Jeff was there. Lenny the Troll, Lenny Omega, the two Lennies. Billy Pilgrim, you know, a lot of the usual suspects. And, you know, again, I say it frequently, you guys are pretty awesome. So thanks for stopping by and following along. To everyone who either did that live or followed or read the report afterwards. You guys like J-Ball or Boycott WWE, appreciate you guys. You know, you read, if you have something to say, you comment, and I appreciate it. If you read and you don't comment, I'm fine with that, too. I appreciate anyone who bothers to read what I write. So thank you all for that very much. Much appreciated. All right. Jeff, what's in the news? Anything that I didn't get a chance to talk about last week or that came out this week that you think deserves discussion?
Well, we lost our first UFC 200 fight.
We did. Derek Brunson injured, right?
Yeah, and Derek, you know, that was a good matchup. He's injured out of the Musasi fight. Musasi might still stay on, but I guess we'll see.
And Donald Cerrone said he wants to fight on UFC 200. He and Musasi can fight.
He also said something pretty pointedly at the post-fight press conference about his pay in the UFC. I don't know if he means that or if he was just being jokey, but, you know, he was talking about, I need to talk to Dana about getting paid now, which is funny because he was always Mr. Company Man saying, I'll fight for free and all that. And
well, it's
and,
nice
saying,
to say
you know,
you'll fight for free until you actually have to fight for free.
Exactly. So, look, Cowboy's my favorite fighter. He's consistently been one of the top performers in the octagon, even though he's never really been able to get over the hump in those big, meaningful fights. So I think he's a guy you want to keep and you want to keep him happy, but I don't know. We'll see. And maybe something Nate Diaz said on MMA Hour, maybe some of what he was saying about what Cerrone's attitude toward fighting for the UFC, maybe it got back to Cerrone and maybe it made him think a little bit. So there's that. In terms of other major news, did we talk about Chad Mendes yet?
We did not. I mentioned it last week in passing that he had been flagged, but there was not enough information at the time for me to say anything other than he had violated something to do with the anti-doping policy. And as we know, that could be that is not in this era necessarily indicative of a failed test for steroids. There's a lot of things that could have violated it. Do we know more now?
No, we don't. All we know is it's a provisional suspension for a potential violation. So it's pretty much the same state.
Okay. You know, I don't know if Chad Mendes is a juicer. I don't think he is. But, you know, I'll say that the man's physique hasn't changed at all since he was in college. If you watch videos of his collegiate wrestling career, hasn't changed a whole lot. But, no, I hadn't mentioned that before. I don't think we'd really talked about that. Do you have anything on that?
I no. It would, honestly, it wouldn't surprise me. Because, I mean, it's confusing to me, the attitude that, like, the guys on the MMA beat are saying the problems with the USADA deal. I mean, this is what the MMA media was practically demanding was to happen. Over the last year. This is what they were essentially asking for, because the same people in the media were saying over half of the industry is on the gear. So, I mean, now they're suddenly criticizing it, and I don't get it at all.
Well, I think there are things about both WADA and the USADA policies that were not examined closely enough upon adoption. And
like
that
what?
Being said, well, that substance Machida got popped for should not be a banned substance, first of all.
I disagree.
It has no anabolic profile. WADA put it on the list because they thought it did. Subsequent testing proved that it did not. Documentation proves no anabolic profile. It's still banned. I don't know why they won't take it off the list, but the point being, there are some issues there that need to be addressed. By the same token, I don't think we should all be surprised when some of these guys start popping, given the numbers that were being floated about the percentage of fighters who might have been on some form of performance-enhancing drug.
Why would he even need to take that? Why would he need to take something like that? And what properties does it even give you?
I don't know. I'm not up on the scientific benefits of supplementation. I know that if you ban something for having an anabolic profile, and it turns out that it doesn't, it should no longer be banned. That's just basic logic.
Again, this is what people...
And besides, WADA as an institution is constantly under fire in the larger sports world for being somewhat inept. However, I will say this. I believe we have a better system in place right now than we did previously. And I am glad that steps were taken. We just need to, I hope we all understand that this is not a final destination. We have not arrived yet. We simply took a positive step.
In terms of other news, I can't really think of too much else that we you guys already would have gone over last week. Anthony, here we go. Anthony Johnson is out of UFC on Fox 20. I forgot about that. So he's out of the sheriff fight. So there you go. That's the other big piece of news that came out this weekend.
That sucks. I was looking forward to that one. They also announced Alexander Gustafsson's next opponent. He gets a layup. They announced he's fighting Jan Blachowicz. Now, I like Jan Blachowicz well enough.
Honestly,
this is a gimme win for
Gustafsson. That's a good fight for people complain about that. I think that's a good fight for Gustafsson at this point in his career because he's coming off two straight losses, is he not?
He is to, I believe, Anthony Johnson and Daniel Cormier.
First to Johnson and then to Cormier. The Cormier fight was for the title, but he still lost two in a row. I think you need to try and give him a fight to build, to give him a win and maybe build his confidence back up if he's going to continue fighting.
Yeah, I'm not complaining that he's getting a bit of a layup. Again, all things considered, he deserves a lower-ranked opponent in this instance.
But,
just
I
noting,
mean, sometimes...
That's kind of a gimmick.
Sometimes,
and
here's the thing
he
should about
be able to perform admirably.
Here's the thing about this sport. Guys in Gustafsson's exact same position, sometimes they miss that layup.
It's true.
When they're giving it, they're giving them all again, and they miss, and they still whiff on it. Because this is, this is not hitting a plastic ball with a club. This is not trying to put a ball through a hoop. It's not trying to hit a ball with a stick. You're going inside a cage and fighting a man unarmed combat, okay? So, I mean, anything can happen, and we've seen it time and time again. I mean, Michael Bisping is the UFC champion. We never predicted that. We probably all predicted that, yeah, that's never going to happen. But that's why Gustafsson, he cannot take a guy like Jan Blaskowitz lightly at all.
Hey, Rashad Evans was supposed to be a rebound for Chuck Liddell to get him back into title contention.
Exactly.
That worked out too well for the Iceman. All right, real quick on the schedule. Unless some major news breaks, we will be off next week. That would be the 26th. Now, if you know news of the UFC sale comes through, or more information about that comes up, major fight shift, if there's some earth-shattering news, we will have a show next Sunday to talk about it. Other than that, we will be off the 26th, and then, oh boy, howdy, the 3rd. You see, the 3rd of July will be our show prior to the 3-set. The day I dread more than just about any, this week I dread more than just about any other. Leading into UFC 200, we have on Thursday, UFC Fight Night 90, Dos Anjos versus Alvarez for the lightweight title. It's not a bad card, all things considered. You know, good main event, decent enough co-main event, Roy Nelson and Derek Lewis. Alan Joban's on that card, Joseph Duffy. There's some good names on that card. It's, again, Fight Pass exclusive and anchored by the main event. The next night, July 8th, we have the finale of Tough 23, which I assume no one cares about because tough. Anyway, that event is headlined by the strawweight title fight between Joanna Jędrzejczyk and Claudia Gadela. It's a good fight. We'll have the other two tough finales. Ross Pearson's fighting Will Brooks on that card. That's a good fight. And then, that is Friday. Then Saturday, July 9th, we have UFC 200. Lot of fights. Let me just double check something. Yeah, okay, that's the 13th. 9. Okay, yeah, we're good there. Okay. And, yeah, the point being, those three events are all right in a row, and I will have live coverage of all of them. So, the 3rd of July, we'll be previewing all three of those events. That ought to be fun on this show. And barring some earth-shattering news next week, again, the 26th, we'll have a week off. All right. With that bit of scheduling out of the way, Jeff, you saw the biggest opening of the week, didn't you? You reviewed Finding Dory.
The biggest animated feature opening of all time, actually. Finding Dory. Did you see it yet, Robert?
Not yet. I will be seeing it and reviewing it on Tuesday.
Okay. So, good movie. Decent movie. Not as good as Finding Nemo, but a good movie nonetheless. And I was quite happy with it overall. So, you can check out my review for that in the movie zone. Plus, probably some more E3 stuff coming along. Independence Day Resurgence, go figure, is not screening the critics, so I will not have an early review up for the sequel that's 20 years in the making, Independence Day Resurgence. You're probably excited about reviewing that one.
You know, if they can match the quality of the first Independence Day, I will be thrilled. That's a low bar. That's all the bar I'm setting, and I'm hoping they can clear that.
But I will check with you back soon, Robert. Thank you, guys.
All right. I'll see you in a couple of weeks, Jeff.
Couple weeks.
All right. I'll get in touch with you on Facebook if we decide to have one tomorrow or next week. All right. This Tuesday, special Tuesday review, Mark Radlich and I will be reviewing Finding Dory. Minor shift. We'll be back to Wednesdays the week after that for Independence Day. Again, we're taking off next week, and I will, unless something major happens, then we'll see you back here on the 3rd of July. All right, that's it for me. For Jeff Harris, I'm Robert Winfrey, reminding everyone to please continue to be well, be safe, and behave, and please continue to share the show. Thank you for spending your time with us. It means the world to me. Thank you all for that. See you next time. Please keep... I'm going to step all over that, aren't I? Continue to be well, be safe, and behave again.